Case 23. Hui Neng, neither good nor evil. The sixth ancestor was pursued by Ming, the head monk, as far as Taiyu Peak. The teacher, seeing Ming coming, laid the robe and bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents the Dharma. There should be no fighting over it. You may take it back with you." Ming tried to lift it up, but it was as immovable as a mountain. Shivering and trembling, he said, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, lay brother, please open the way for me." The teacher said, "Don't think good, don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming, the head monk?" In that instant, Ming had great satori. Sweat ran from his entire body. In tears, he made his bows, saying, "Beside these secret words and secret meanings, is there anything of further significance?" The teacher said, "What I have just conveyed to you is not secret. If you reflect on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you." Ming said, "Though I practiced at Huangmei with the assembly, I could not truly realize my original face. Now, thanks to your pointed instruction, I am like someone who drinks water and knows personally whether it is cold or warm. Lay brother, you are now my teacher." The teacher said, "If you can say that, then let us both call Huangmei our teacher. Maintain your realization carefully." Wu Men's comment: it must be said that the sixth ancestor forgets himself completely in taking action here. He is like a kindly grandmother who peels a fresh lychee, removes the seed, and puts it in your mouth. Then you only need to swallow it down. Woman's verse: it can't be described, it can't be pictured, it can't be praised enough. Stop groping for it. The original face has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed. So in what feels like the third millennium of this session, I find myself doing what I often do, which is to take the different roles in the koan. And right now, what's most alive for me is Hui Neng, this illiterate monk with nothing, running away, running. Finally turning and facing his pursuer and standing his ground. Awesome. I think about what I would do in that position. I think of myself facing this Rambo-like former general, quaking in my sandals and saying, "Robe? What? How'd this robe get into my satchel?" Jeannie was saying last night that she has a monk Ming that lives inside her, and I have my own special and very lively monk Ming. The monk Ming who visits me every day, every moment on Sesshin, and says, "You should not be where you are. You should not have what you have. You do not have the right stuff. You are an imposter." Perhaps some of you have your own monk Ming, or for some of you, maybe it's not monk Ming, maybe it's nun Ming, but that voice that visits us in our hell realms. that says, you are not a real friend. You are not a real partner. You are not a real Zen student. Can't do it. Give it up. Let others who know better take it on. This was so vivid for me when I was about to become a father for the first time. I was sure for some reason that my wife and I were going to have a girl. And I planned for it. And then the blood test came back and I found out we were having a boy. And my feeling right away that came up was, I can't be a father to a boy. I don't know how to throw a football. I don't hunt. I don't fish. I don't know how to use power tools. What kind of a father could I be to a boy? And of course, it arises in every area of life when we're here and present for whatever comes up. Arises, passes away, arises again. And almost everyone who I know well will admit to me at some point that they too feel not good enough, an imposter, not doing the real thing in some areas of their life. We hear the birds out there, not wondering, am I doing the right bird call? Do I have the right stuff to be here in this tree right now? So how is it that we beings, find that it arises for us so much? And I find here the teaching of David Lloyd to be very helpful. He's a Zen teacher and a philosopher. And he brings us back to that experience we all have on the cushion, where we ask, who am I? Who is it who hears this sound? Who is it whose knee is aching? And of course we can't find this self that feels so real, that feels so permanent. Nowhere to be found. And David Loy says that it's not the fear of death that is our deepest fear. It's the fear that we are not real. That most people never allow themselves to look into who am I in the way that sometimes happens. That most of us are just desperately trying to shore up the self, to make the self real in every way we can. That some people try to amass great wealth for its own sake, fame for its own sake, consuming the earth. Things that are inherently empty, things that are harmful, in a desperate attempt to feel real. And so, of course, we conjure up these identities, as Alan was talking about, of being the one who's always laid back, of being the one who's always powerful, of being the one who's always the naysayer, of being the real father, the real Zen student. And then we see that these constructions hold us tight. They narrow our vision. And in those moments of grace, we glimpse so much bigger a universe. Can't ever be that father. I could change a diaper. I could read Goodnight Moon over and over again until I could not stand it anymore. I could have pillow fights. I could struggle with my teenagers when they decided they no longer needed any limits from me. So what do we do when we feel like imposters, but the world needs us to live into our roles? Hui Neng doesn't cower, and he doesn't say, "Who, me? Oh, no, no, go ahead, yeah. He steps up. What ground is there for him to stand on? Because, as Julie told us, there's no parachute and there is no ground. But he takes refuge in the three treasures. He takes refuge in the fact of awakening, in the Buddha. He takes refuge in the truth of these teachings and offers them to Monk Ming. And he takes refuge in the Sangha. He says, "Lay brother, we are not separate. We are, at the deepest level, together, bowing to this practice." And so we find that we can't do these roles that our non-existent selves create, because these roles can't begin to express the thusness of moving through our lives. And yet the world needs us to show up just as we are, as homemakers, as workers, as friends, as Zen students, knowing that we can't do it. So this morning, I woke up and Meng Ming was there, Monk Ming, saying to me, "You can't, you are not a Zen teacher. Who are you kidding?" And the bell rang, and I got up, put on my 7-piece robe, came here. And all of you, with your Mings, came here to meet me. No one can do it for us, but we cannot do it alone. So here we are, completely unable to live out these images. And everything we encounter is our life. And now, a man who really knows how to use power tools will finish this talk.
Yeah, so the feeling of a skill saw in your head. I think the noise is a big part of the excitement of it. Actually, I do have a skill saw. I bought it 20 years ago in order to be a man. And I think I've used it twice. Now my skill saw is quite rusty. I'm afraid if I ever tried to use it, who knows what would happen? The accoutrements of our life. these roles, these images of the roles, these images of who we should be, what it really means to be a Zen student, what it really means to be a father, a mother. And the mind creates some image and then compares ourself to some image. And I love this idea. In all the years I've studied and worked with this koan, I never thought of Monk Ming as the critic. But certainly he embodies the great certainty of the critic. For most of us, the judge, the critic, the backseat driver is very sure of himself or herself. No doubt at all. And sometimes I admire that about my inner critic. He is much more certain than I am. So how to appreciate this inner critic? If we fight with those voices, if we try to win the argument, no, I am a real man, I have a skill saw even though I don't use it, the critic always has one more criticism, right? And in fact, the inventiveness and creativity of the critic is marvelous. You can do it and then criticize yourself for doing it. You cannot do it and then criticize yourself for not doing it. This inner judge, quite wonderful about using available material, right? I'm trying too hard. I just need to not try so hard. Oh, I'm not trying hard enough. I must try harder. Endless. And this endless chatter and this endless division of the self is life itself. All of this appears in the mind of the Tathagata. All the illusory guises we read this morning, all the selves that come up, all the internal struggles, the wars inside and the wars outside, all of this appears in the vast heart-mind of awakening. In the middle of the stew of life, this great upheaval, this great appearing of a heartbeat. That heartbeat that appears so early, and that heartbeat that we did not start, that heartbeat that is you, the particularness that is you, that is the result of causes and conditions of your parents and their parents and on back. Everything in the whole universe has conspired to appear as you. As I was saying in the beginning, we are practicing being ourselves. And in the midst of these minds, or with these wonderful minds, wonderful, wonderful, that we can think and plan and create images, we have to sometimes hack our way through the weeds. To begin to tune out the endless bad advice of the inner critic. As Dogen says, to step back and turn the light within. Who am I? And this who am I is not a question that can be answered with words. In some ways, if your answer starts, "I am," you're already on the wrong track. This question, who am I, this essence of life that is manifesting as you, is already perfectly manifesting. We say mistake, we say success, we say failure. All of these are merely words. Words that are burned up in the vastness and the inconceivable blessing and the inconceivable difficulty of life. But one of the clues, how do I proceed? What do I do? Where do I go? For me, the question is, what do I love? What is it that brings me alive? Where do I find joy? At this deep level, not simply what is easiest or what is most pleasurable, but to listen deeply. Each one of us called into this world to manifest love. To manifest this great heart of the Dharma as ourselves. So easy to look at other people and say, I should be more like. I wish I were. And this is okay. We see parts of ourself in other people. But to know that what you admire in someone else, you would not admire it if it were not in you. So what you see, what you imagine in that person this person is the mirror for you. The mirror of your own wisdom, the mirror of your own great heart. And this person that you are, this Buddha that you are, you can never know. Because any idea you have about it becomes the next box that you have to get out of. You are everything and you are not a thing. We can never know ourselves. We can only live into the moment. And in this living into the moment, ringing the bell when it's time to ring the bell, standing up, bowing when it's time to bow, this is the expression of our great love. This is the manifestation of the Buddha of me. And to manifest this, as Bob was saying, takes great courage. Because Ming and his cohorts, all of the voices in your head, shout their bad advice. No need to be distracted by them. But simply to take the next step, to play the role that is required in the moment. One of the things I love about our Boundless Way community is how we change roles. One moment it's this, and then the next moment it's Samu, and time to weed the garden, or time to wash the dishes. And this activity of serving, of giving ourselves, the activity of life, is the manifestation and requires incredible courage and faith. There is no one who can authorize you to be yourself except you. And if you try to authorize yourself, you will be caught in another box. But there is the possibility of stepping into our life in the most intimate way. And when we step into our life in this intimate way, there is no self to protect, no robe and bowl to claim or fight over. There is only the great aliveness, the great pain in the knee, the great joy in the heart, the great vividness of seeing the trees. So this is our way. The way of faith and the way of courage. The way of coming back. The great way of expressing the love, the appreciation that we find arises. This indeed is the Dharma. This indeed is the transmission to each one of us. Thank you. So please sit comfortably. People in the back can come around if you'd like. Yeah, Todd, you can come up and sit in the aisle here.
Sure.
So, Ken.
Like Laura, I only talk when I quiver inside. So. I also had not, like David, seen Ming and Hui Ning in interactions like that. It occurred to me that's what I'm experiencing and learning with this Sesshin. Ming is all those parts of me, the parts of myself that are trying to form or telling me this is who I am, whether good or bad, not just a critic, but just... This is who who I am. This is what the situation is. This is what's trying to form. And Hui Ning, by just turning and facing and looking at me, basically in silence, and just, I'm not here to argue. I'm just here to look, to listen. And at that point, Ming can't hold it together as a voice. He cannot lift the rope. He cannot form what he wants to make of me or this moment. And so the rope and bowl not just are immovable because they're heavy, immovable because they're empty. There's nothing there to hold on to. And that's only when Hui Ning turns and faces and looks. When I turn and look and face that voice, and it just, there's no barrier, there's no wall, there's no opposition. So it just, it can't do anything but dissolve.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was, like, really touched my heart. And that is very much what practice feels like for me. Just turning again toward not needing to keep running anymore. To stop, stand still, look at it. This is, it's just a sense of self.
Thank you. Yeah, I love that Wei Ming didn't duke it out with Monk Ming. Because he probably would have lost. Right? Yeah, but this power beyond the conflict. And I love too that these voices telling us who we are, both plus and minus. Oh, you're really good this, and boy, you're doing a good job this afternoon, right? Just as pernicious, right?
The other thing, when you said he probably would have lost if they duked it out.
Yeah.
Immediately I had the thought that Ming is exhausted. And then I thought, Hui Ning is exhausted too. These two people meet in their exhaustion. These two parts of ourselves meet in their exhaustion. Here we are at Sesshin. And we're not just exhausted because we're dehydrated. Right? There's other reasons. And there is something about a wearing away, right? And I know this, you know this. It's like, oh, I just can't maintain it anymore. I am tired. that there's a, David and I just watched a Netflix special before Sashim.
No, really.
called Nanette, Australian comic named Hannah Gadsby. I really recommend it. It is extraordinary. If you can get through the first 15 minutes, which are just like a mediocre comedy special, it heads in another direction entirely. But towards the beginning, she says, you know, I used to identify as a woman, as a lesbian, but now I'm just tired. I identify as tired. Right? And I just, whoa, that was a great comment. You know, so we have to get tired of maintaining the self.
And Ken, I love that you pointed to the robe, and the robe as empty, right? Because part of the exhaustion that we get into is confusing the symbol of something with just this. And no, it's really, the robe is really important. You know, and Hui Neng just says, look,
I finally feel like I heard the first line of the commentary. The first few times I heard it, I was sure that I was misunderstanding, because it says he forgets himself. That's sort of about the hero of the story.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we say you forget yourself, that's something that you've done something wrong. Mm-hmm. And so this time I heard it, that's meant as a compliment in this case, is he forgets himself. That's what we're supposed to do. And I realized as Bob was talking that I feel like I, sort of the opposite of everything he said. I feel like anything that's wrong, I can fix it. That it's just, you know, I've got to put in some effort. And, if something's wrong, if I can't lift the robe, there's something wrong with the robe. It's sticky, I feel like I can't forget myself. I don't have the inner critic that's telling me I'm doing things wrong. And it's just like, you just need to do something else. Oh, you just need to figure out this other thing. And it doesn't, I don't feel tired. I feel like I'm just gotta keep going.
Mm.
And I'm, I feel like part of that is I can't forget myself. I feel like I'm where I'm supposed to be, and somehow that's not where I'm not sure exactly. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't feel like it's wrong. It just feels something.
And what's it like for you when you can't fix it?
It's like any other time. Need to find the thing to fix it.
Yeah.
Looking for something to fix it.
Yeah. Well, and this is, so we can imagine where we should be in the story, but we find ourselves in some part of the story, and this place of I just need to find something to fix it. So I would encourage you to fix whatever you can. Right? Because, and there really are things to be fixed. There really is something to be done. And so this is a natural tendency of love and connection. Let me do what I can in this situation. So to really give our all, to wholeheartedly fix whatever can be fixed. Right? And trust that if this is what's present in you, then we embody that part. Well, let me be the fixer. And I will fix whatever I can. And then see what's next. Right? Trusting that.
There is... this isn't exactly what you're talking about, but it's related. In your case, it's this habit of looking to see what I can fix. And all of us have various habits. And sometimes it can sound like we're saying, get rid of all your habits, you know, be free, you know, drop it all. But that's not really, in my experience, what Zen practice is. It's it's persisting with the things that we know how to do, and seeing that there's also, in addition, not instead of, another way. It would be a real shame. Like, many of us here have professions where we can't really use our Zen practice in those professions. It would be unskillful. You know, some of us are therapists, academics, plumbers. We work with technology. There's so many different things we do. And if we just dropped all that and said, no, I'm just going to be present. I'm tired of this. It wouldn't serve the world. So there's some way where it isn't about avoiding the strategy. There's some way where we begin to see it's a strategy. And there's another way as well, probably an infinite number of ways, to be human. And so that's why I've said a couple of times that this work never ends. Because there's the constant seeing something new, then integrating it, then seeing more that's new, then integrating it. And a kind of forgetting. You know, and in that, I never thought of that either, the first line of the commentary, of Wu Min's commentary, because he doesn't just forget the self and then sit. He forgets the self and looks around for some leechiness, right? He became a teacher. He peels it and he puts it in your mouth. So that's his strategy. I'm not just going to sit here. The Buddha wanted to do that. The Buddha just wanted to sit. After he had his great realization, he just wanted to hang out with it. Why not? But then that wasn't what his life was about, and it took some other people telling him that to get him up off his rump and make this mess that we're in right now.
And the other thing I just want to say about these strategies is that part of our work is to see it. To you know, I agree with Melissa, we can't change it, right? If we intentionally say, well, okay, I see what's wrong with me, or I see what the problem is, this is where I'm not in alignment, I'm just going to change it. It has to be, and it's what Jeannie was talking about last night, about this just being present with whatever comes up. And what Ken was saying, just turning toward it and observing, what is this? How does it operate? And in that, comes some, it's not, whatever it is, it's not what we think it is. Yeah. Thank you.
Referring once again to Jeannie's talk, I was so touched by the cigarette portion. I never smoked, but my parents smoked, so I could imagine what that was like. And what I taught mindfulness in the inner city for a number of years, and everybody in my class smoked, and there was no way for me to get them to stop smoking. So we made up a smoking meditation, which was like really paying attention to every single part. It was very similar to what Jeannie was saying. First you get the unwrapped package and you feel that, and then you take the gold thing and you undo it and the smell comes, and then you take one out and you smell it. I mean, I won't go on because some of you probably are.
Yeah, I need a form of smoking.
I need a cigarette. Oh my God. There's no smoking anywhere in the temple or on the grounds. You're gonna have to go down the street. So, sorry about that. But what happened to these folks, to a person, is that they changed their relationship to smoking. Now it doesn't mean they stopped, but they really knew what it was like. They really knew what happened to their bodies. They felt the whole thing. Everything slowed down. I just love that. And of course, we do this with everything. You know, just pay attention.
Julie?
So there's another line that's been running around in my head that people haven't talked about too much. But somebody apparently thinks it's important enough to name the koan after it. Don't think good, don't think evil. And I guess I'm feeling, you know, I mean, we're really going at it from the side of emptiness, about that image of myself as a good person, that image of myself as a bad person, who's right, who's wrong, who's the real teacher, who's the imposter. And in that moment, they let it go. And there's the other side of the form and the relative world. And there are some people whose inner critic is asleep on the job and should not be.
Okay. Can you think of anyone in particular?
Recently had a discussion about band teachers who are sexually abusive and somehow have this feeling that they can't do evil anymore because they're a spiritual leader. You know, their Ming needs to wake up. I guess it's just a feeling that there really are, you know, I can definitely feel the where I want to be a good person gets in the way of my life. I become much more fixated on some image of what a good person is than actually living my life. And then there's the other side of, you know, if I have an inner critic saying I made a mistake, maybe I should take a look. Or an outer critic saying I made a mistake. And that's even tougher because, you know, then my ego is bruised. But, maybe a good thing.
Yeah, thank you for saying that because, you know, it's easy just to take from what I said, oh, let's just get rid of Ming and we'll be fine. Right? No, absolutely not. Some people need more Ming, more cowbell.
I had this other thought about Ming, which I've thought about before. So the problem with him is not that he was doing what he was doing. It was that he was deluded about why he was doing it. And I think the inner critic is really deluded about why he or she is being so oppressively negative. Because I think the inner critic loves us and wants us to do our best. And so, you're right, and along these lines, to get rid of it would be impossible, for one thing, because then you'd have to chop away a piece of yourself. But to listen to it, you know, but not teach it how to communicate its criticisms better.
I realize I said that some people have a critic that's asleep at the wheel. I should say this person has a critic that in some blind spots is asleep at the wheel. Yeah, of course. As well.
So I just want to also talk about something that we do as Zen teachers and practitioners. We kind of use language of emptiness and form. And it's another way of dividing the world in our lives. And I just want to name it as a tool that we're using here. It's not a thing. For me, it's sometimes helpful, rather than to say the self is empty or something like that, to call it a sense of self. It is something that arises, like everything else. And it displays itself, and then I sometimes act on it, I sometimes don't, I consider it. But no matter what, eventually it is changing, it is shifting, it is not solid. I sometimes think it is. That's a delusion that causes a lot of pain for me when that arises. So observing that the sense of self is shifting and empty of fixed substance and not separate doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It exists and it arises for all of us, and it's very useful. That moment of feeling ashamed or embarrassed is a great warning light that maybe I have done something that has harmed somebody. I don't have to believe it immediately. I can look into it. I can ask about it. I don't have to believe every sense of self that arises. But I can be aware of it. This is a sense of self. And then look carefully and make a decision. So.
I guess I feel the troublemaker coming back. I actually really wanted to pick up the idea of self-forgetfulness as, you know, like a mistake or a... I mean, what's been striking me so much is I guess I'm a person who has felt very much like I... whatever comfort I've found in life has been largely by following the rules, learning what the rules were, doing it, finding out how to do it as best I can, and not doing the things where I'm not very good at it, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So the kind of surprise for me is the feeling like, you know, I've been doing too much, and I actually can kind of not believe, I keep getting this glimmering that I could be really irresponsible, that instead of exhorting me to be more responsible and connect this long, very difficult and painful past that I'm feeling with a future where, you know, I'm going to come out of this place and people are going to, you know, expect me to be the way I was or expect me to be really different, and I have to kind of live up and I have to kind of connect those things. You know, all this past and all this future, I'm not responsible for those. They actually don't exist. I've been working really hard to connect them and to be responsible for them. But actually, you know, it's almost like I can't believe it. Like, we just get to party in the now? I mean, whoa! You know, like, that's really irresponsible, and I love it. I love it. You know? Yeah.
We do just get to party at the now. This is the party. And those things really did happen in the past, and things really will happen in the future. But I think you're right in pointing out what you're talking about, I think, is how hard we work to maintain a narrative that connects the past to the future. And the thing about the past is those things you remember did happen, maybe close enough to what you remember, but probably not exactly accurately. And many, many other things happen too that you've forgotten, that you never knew about. And many things will happen in the future, and you'll only get to live out one particular narrative strain. So we say, and Dogen is famous for saying this, that the past and the future, we tend to think of them as going from past to present to future. But really, the past goes to the present and the future goes to the present, because that's how our minds work. And there's this constant coming in. We don't have to cut them off either and exclude them. They're moving in their own way to inform the party.
I guess I just want to say, the thing that is news to me is that I'm maintaining these narratives, I have to look in there. No, but I felt like I had to do that.
Well, right.
Like that was number one. I mean, I didn't realize I could put that down. I thought I was supposed to put something else down. I thought I was really responsible for this thing.
Yeah.
How does it feel?
I almost can't believe it. You know? I can't believe it. Really? I don't have to do that? Are you sure? Is there, you know, like, do the police know about you guys?
The firemen do.
Yeah, they do.
They know.
Oh. Thanks.
Yeah.
I just wanted to thank you for coming forward and just point to this liberation that you're so beautifully talking about, I want to say singing about, and demonstrating, and say, you know, and you're in a long line of our ancestors who have sung about the liberation that we find. And it often doesn't look anything like we think it will. We look for it. We all search for this freedom. This liberation, how can I feel this way, please? And when we taste it, sometimes, as several people have talked about, preparing to be surprised, right? It appears and it feels and tastes and just is not quite what we expected, but oh, wow. Much better, perhaps, than anything we ever dreamed of.
Like, so much is given. I mean, what I have to provide is so tiny.
Yes.
What a relief.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah, right. The lychee nut.
Yeah.
Anybody in the back thinking about raising their hand?